Blog Talk Radio.
Just Energy with naturopath and medical intuitive Dr. Rita Louise. We have learned from Einstein's theories that matter and energy are one. Physicists believe that all systems in nature have their own particular way of vibrating. From the swing of a pendulum to the waves in the ocean to the light that brightens the sky each day, each of these oscillates at its own unique rate. In the same way, things such as rocks and minerals vibrate very slowly and at speeds that are imperceptible to us. Living things such as plants, animals, and man vibrate faster and appear to be alive. The same holds true for every thought, feeling, event, or word we speak. Each has its own frequency or rate of vibration. What many of us don't realize is if we take everything in our own universe down to its simplest form, it is all just energy. Join Dr. Rita as she explores questions such as, what are we made of? Why do we get sick? How can I live a more balanced and whole life? Call in and talk to her and her thought-provoking guests. Send us your questions and get the help you need to move beyond any obstacles or challenges that may be affecting your life, right from the source. So stay tuned and explore your possibilities.
Say Merry Christmas to everyone, and well, I'll be saying Happy New Year to you next week. So we're doing a live remote from Winterville, and I want to tell you, it's pretty cold here. I haven't seen Santa yet, but I am waiting for Santa to show up to make his deliveries, because I'm ready to get some cool presents. It happens, you know, at least it happens in my house. Also, I want to let you know, in 2 weeks, we will be celebrating the 4th year of broadcasting, so the completion of 4 years broadcasting of Just Energy Radio. And if you haven't been listening to the show for a really long time, you can listen to all 4 years or get access to all 4 years of archives at the Just Energy Radio website, which is www.justenergyradio.com. Also, on my main site, which is soulhealer.com, there's information about these services and products that I offer, including medical intuition evaluations, energy medicine certification if you want to get some energy work done. Pretty much anything that you would like to do, you can, or find out about me, you can do at that soulhealer.com website. And so we're waiting for our guest to call in, because he's calling in from out of the country, and so I'm just going to kind of keep talking here for a little bit. If you're out there, Nigel, if you could hit the #1 button to let me know that you are there, I would really appreciate that. But in the meantime, I'm going to bring a good friend of mine on the show here for a while to just visit and talk about Christmas for a minute. So, hello, Wayne, are you there?
Oh, hi.
Hey, how are you doing? Merry Christmas.
Oh, Merry Christmas to you, too. I'm deep in the eastern side of the country, United States, and a place called North Carolina, and suffering through very cold and sometimes moderate weather.
Sometimes cold and moderate weather? Well, you know, I'm in Winterville, and I just to keep making comments about waiting for because obviously Winterville has to be a suburb of the North Pole, because it feels like it's as cold as the North Pole here. And so, you know, I'm waiting for Santa to make an appearance, because I've been a good girl, I think, this past year. And so I'm thinking that I should be getting some good gifts. Maybe. It could happen.
Oh, I don't know. I talked to Santa, and I understand that you've been naughty and nice this year.
So, you know, I was really excited about this show today, because we're supposed to be talking about gray aliens and the harvesting of souls. you know, and how there has been a conspiracy to genetically tamper with humanity. And so I've been really excited about, you know, talking on this topic with our guest, Nigel Kerner, but he isn't here right now, which is really kind of a bummer and upsetting. But what do you think about that whole topic? Do you think we were genetically engineered?
Well, I have done an awful lot of studying regarding alien intervention into mankind's development through these, not just centuries, but millenniums. And beyond that, and the majority of my interest was turned towards the writings of a man named Sitchin. I found his writings most intriguing because he was one of the few people in the world able to translate Sumerian text into English, or into any language for that matter. And he began translating not text, but scrolls, I guess, or you can help me out with it. Writing tablets, that's what it was. He was writing text regarding, or writing books regarding the content of those tablets. And he very clearly, very definitely believed that aliens were involved in mankind's evolution, going as far back as millions of years. Clearly, according to the text that he transcribed, which was all pre-science now, I'd like to make that point clear, the scientists today are just now, you know, developing genetic engineering and getting into chromosomes and splitting them and this sort of thing. But the text that he translated described that process, in my mind at least, very clearly. And those tablets were written, again, thousands of years ago, 20, 50,000 years ago. So somehow, either we had a very advanced civilization on the planet here, you know, some think maybe Atlanteans, and it's possible even then that the Atlanteans were aliens. But in every case, they talk about how they transformed various animals on our planet to be more and more like them, whoever they were.
Well, yeah, and I've been reading some of the Sumerian tablets myself, and I think it's interesting because in the Babylonian creation myth, it talks about the gods toiling the land and them getting really pissed off about it and having this uprising against one of the gods, Enel. And so they decide to create, and I love the term, it's so politically incorrect, the blackheaded people. And they created this race of people to do the work. And the more tablets that you read, there's all of this stuff going on, and there's the blackheaded people who weren't even part of this group of people. They weren't even servants to this group of people because they were just the blackheaded people, you know, kind of like you would talk about your dog or your cat or, you know, something that wasn't even had any kind of intelligence, you know, or what we would consider, you know, intelligence or consciousness, which I find fascinating that, you know, we think we're so great and we're so great, but apparently, according to these people, we were dumber than a box of rocks. Or is it less significant than a box of rocks?
Well, yeah, you know, again, Sitchin took a lot of information and condensed it down into his books, I guess very similar to and paralleled a lot with what the Bible says, and that parallel didn't become obvious until many years after he'd done his work, but... he describes these aliens from was it Nibiru?
Nibiru.
I hope I'm saying it correctly. Who came to Earth to rape the planet of its gold, essentially? And while they were here, you know, they established colonies, and they had people with them from their planet to do the work. They were supposed to go into the mines and dig the gold up, and most of that took place in Africa. And they got tired of doing all the slave work, essentially, while the more senior people in their colonies were living the good life. They were living in temples and having hot meals and having their bodies fanned and while the heat flies off them. And, I mean, they were generally having a good time, you know, drink, wine, women, song. And that, of course, over thousands of years on Earth, was causing the people who had to do the work to be very unhappy about it, even though they were from the same planet. And,
well, and I think the part that's interesting about that is the people, those people, that race of people, according to the text, you know, it wasn't like they lived 30, 40, 50, 60 years. They lived for hundreds of years or thousands of years. Okay, hold on one sec. Hold on. All right. Wayne, just keep talking here a second, okay?
Sure. So anyway, while the people from Nibiru were mining the gold and they were starting to experience very unhappy workers, they had a council meeting one day. And oh, I want to talk about the time lapsing in here too, because Nibiru had one day was equal to 300 and something Earth days. Or Earth years, excuse me, Earth years. And so a person from Nibiru would live one day equal to 300 and something Earth years. And so they lived, again, as Rita, Dr. Rita just said, for thousands of years on Earth. And our own Bible refers to people who lived thousands of years on Earth. So we can see that correlation, and it explains how so many things or events could occur in on Earth and occur at the hands of persons who were able to live that long. But on Earth, using Earth time, we'd be looking at it and saying, well, you know, this took 300 or 400 years. How were they able to get that kind of evolution? The answer is they were there to nurse it along very readily, and they were the same people who led to the evolution of mankind without changing faces or names. It was the same people over and over again. And,
hey, Wayne?
Yes.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but we have Nigel here. Apparently
Wonderful.
He's been here. And so you're welcome to stay as part of the conversation, or I can mute you. But let me get Nigel on, and let's kind of get this show going. Okay? So are you going to hang out, or are you going to cut out on us?
Well, I'll hang out, and you go ahead and mute me, and if I need to ask a question, I'll jump in there if I can.
Okay. Sounds good to me. All right. I'll talk to you on the other side. Okay. So apparently Nigel has been there, and there's just been, I don't know. It looked like a local number, not an international number. Anyway, so let me tell you a little bit about Nigel, and we will get him on the air, and we're going to start talking about this great alien and the harvesting of souls because I'm fascinated. Nigel Koerner is the author and is an author and freelance journalist. He was born in Sri Lanka, his mother from a British planting family, and his father an officer in the British Royal Navy Fleet Air Arm. This international family base provided the background for an obsessive and serious interest in international human affairs and how these interface with science, religion, and philosophy. So please welcome to Just Energy Radio, Nigel Koerner. Hi, Nigel. I am so sorry about this confusion.
No apologies necessary. As I said to you, it was beginning to sound like the Indian love call here. So greetings to you, Rita.
Well, greetings to you, too. I do have a question. Is it you and a couple of other people who are joining us,
yeah,
or is it just you today?
Yeah, indeed, we've got Dr. Andrew Silverman, who's a medical doctor.
Hi, I'm Andrew.
Hi, Andrew.
Hi, nice to be here.
And we've got Dr. John Bickerstaff, who is, in fact, a biochemistry professor, and he's actually in America there, in one of the universities there. Hello?
Hi, John. How are you? Thank you. Merry Christmas to all of you. And thank you.
And to you, too.
I mean, I just was flabbergasted that you guys wanted to come on the show on Christmas Eve, but one of the things that Danielle said when I was communicating with your peeps was that somehow, and we're definitely going to get into this a little bit later in the show, but this is kind of my teaser, somehow aliens are connected with the Shroud of Turin. And I can't wait to hear how that all pulls itself together. But let's and that was kind of our Christmas theme, you know, Shroud of Turin, Jesus, Christmas.
Well, it sounds kind of bizarre, doesn't it?
It does sound kind of bizarre. And so I think, well, myself, and I'm sure the listeners are going, aliens, Shroud of Turin. I'm not seeing the connect, but I am sure you guys will pull it together for all of us.
Wasn't something we were looking for, but it's something that actually happened whilst doing all the research, and it became quite apparent that there was a very strong and perhaps pervading connection between this artifact and what really we're going to talk about, you know, tonight, we hope, if technology allows us to do that.
Well, I guess if you were listening to the beginning of the show while I was talking to my husband, Wayne, you heard us talking about Zachariah Sitchin and the aliens coming to Earth for gold, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so what do you guys, I'm just going to call you guys, think about that whole theory in general as far as what you found in your research?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't go along with Sitchin in his presumptions in passe, so to speak, but there is obviously a very, very powerful connection between the destiny of our species, Homo sapiens, to be stated technically, and the fact that there has been a huge measure of technological upsurge and so forth since a relatively short historical time, so to speak. A sudden kind of switch into a huge brain, and then from that the most incredible thing was the expanse of the pelvic girdle allowing that brain to come through and so forth. Anyway, the whole thing started, you know, Rita, as a kind of response to a very simple little question that my son asked me when he was 12 years old. Dad, are aliens for real? Is there such a thing as a real UFO? And of course, I was in the situation not to answer him. I was, you know, I had the same old background that most of us have, going back with Buck Rogers and the old comic books and all the rest of it. And to me, that kind of thing was in the realm of the Tooth Fairy and so on. And I wanted to actually say to him, give him a flippant answer and say, you know, it's the Mickey Mouse world and so forth. But I thought I'd better hold back because he's a pretty well hitched up young kid at the time. And he was likely to come back at me later on and have a real go at me and prove me wrong. So I thought I'd better do a little bit of research and come back to him. Well, my conclusions are really based on 30 years of painstaking research into this whole question, because as soon as I got going and started connecting up the dots, it was apparent to me that I was dealing with something absolutely sensational here, something, in fact, that in the end overturned all the premises I ever believed in, all existential premises and so on. So I was trying to get a realistic and logical, you know, look at the phenomenon based on empirical science, where that was relevant, and a look, you know, further into these factors that science, through its systemic and kind of procedural invective, if you like, Rita, where that cannot reach. And having looked at all of that, I came, and connecting up the dots, I came to the conclusion that there was a fantastic and giant secret here hidden in the kind of body politic of history, so to speak, that gave us a huge and very new take on what we were all based on and so forth. So I've examined this body of evidence for an alien phenomenon from reliable witness reports, abduction accounts, you know, the usual thing, and taken a look at these in a broader context provided by science, philosophy, and ancient religious texts. And I found that the most intriguing of them all, and before I, you know, make a comment on Zachariah Sitchin's conclusions and so on, and incidentally, that was a very interesting discussion you had previously. I was listening to that while I was trying to get in touch with you. These Gnostic texts were the most revealing of all, I found. And the Nag Hammadi Codex, for example, detail at length a very powerful connection, as it turned out, with this individual, this teacher, this Judaic teacher, Jesus Christ, Jeshua ben Yosef, to give him his Hebrew name. And then, of course, we went into the ancient Hindu text describing Vimanas, a kind of craft that flies to the sky, you know, powered by Mercury. Ancient Egypt and ancient Greece are full of legends describing gods visiting the earth and so on. Then we've got the Old Testament, so full of accounts, such as the very famous one of Ezekiel's wheel, with its glowing lights and burning bush and the laser column that followed the children of Israel and so on. And here it was, you know, there were very powerful, strong hints. Something here was going on. Something was not right in the state of Denmark, so to speak, to put Shakespeare, about this whole business of our history. And that, of course, led me into all kinds of various places, and a Pandora's box finally opened up. And then the whole thing began to make sense. And the final connection, of course, as I said to you, the title of the book was actually given by my publisher, but it wasn't the one I'd put forward, but they thought this was a better way of actually getting the story to the public, so forth. And, of course, that then made a very strong, all this religious connotations made a very strong connection with something that is absolutely sensational in terms of what we've discovered about it and what people are discovering about it, the Shroud of Turin. And Dr. Silverman is here to talk about that because he's the expert on that particular side of it.
Yeah, I would just like to say a little bit, if I may, about just sort of going on from what Nigel was saying about science and how he's sort of taken things a bit further. The interesting thing about science is that although if you actually look at what the word means from its Greek root, it's about knowledge. But generally, scientists tend to limit things to the empirical method, meaning that they're only interested in what you can see, hear, smell, what you can access through the senses. But what it tends to miss is what's behind those senses, the actual sentience, the consciousness that can experience those senses. And that's what I've really appreciated, I think, about Nigel's work, is that he's actually using science in the sense of reason to look a little bit deeper and to try and see things in a broader context. If I just take a little example, for example, there was a professor of this type of thing, a professor of psychiatry at Harvard called John Mack, who wanted to study, he was interested in what people were calling the abduction phenomenon. He wanted to study it from the point of view of a psychiatrist. He assumed that he was going to be finding what kind of delusion these people were having or personality problems that made them want to come up with these stories. But on studying lots and lots of people, many people who had these abduction experiences, he actually surprised himself and came to the conclusion that what they were really doing was describing things that had actually happened to them, that they didn't show any kind of what psychopathology of any delusions or hallucinations, that they were describing something that happened to them that had lots of things in common that many of them hadn't ever heard about until it happened to them. And it's interesting, there are actually a lot of scientists who do sort of are able to see a little bit outside the box, and I think John Mack was one example of that. Sadly, he's no longer with us, but I think a lot of what Nigel's saying, you can see how it can be rooted in reason when you take science a bit further and ask yourself the question about what is humanity and where does that come from.
Hello, I hope. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Rita. I don't want to break in, but there's, you know, sometimes the technological thing, I'm told, you know, cuts off voices and so on. I don't want to be rude. The point is, it's rather awe-inspiring the subject as you go into it, because one box opens another box, and you've got to be outside the box to get at the truth of this one. So the empirical scientific stance as such is a forbidding weapon in that sense, if you see what I'm trying to say. One has to look completely outside at other ways of measuring the human experience, if you like. But if you look at the great scientists of our world, people like Stephen Hawking and Michio Kaku, who've taken a logical look, you know, at the likelihood of alien life and tried to predict, you know, what intentions such life might have for our species, they conclude that it is almost certain that technologically advanced alien life forms must exist, and that such life forms are likely to be predatory towards us, and that is, with an accent, that is the important thing. If you have an advanced expression against something else, you will always dominate that something else, as the Native Americans know when Columbus landed on the shores of America, so to speak. And that is just, it seems, a natural thing commensurate with the fact that we have a powerful satanic force, I would say, and I use the word advisedly, in our midst, so to speak, and that's a science law, a universal law called the second law of thermodynamics, which progressively rots everything. It simply says that things go into greater states of randomness and chaos with time, so everything breaks up. Everything in the end, including the particles that make up atoms and so forth, are unwound, and one day there would be a cold nothingness, everything gone, reason, all measures of expression, extrapolation disappeared from the universe. The universe itself will be a nothingness, a finite mechanism there, if you see what I'm trying to say. So why, you've got to ask that incredible question, why are we here? Why are we here to see all this, to know all this? Why are we here with all the wondrous measures we have, such as music and poetry and the wonderful, you know, the senses that we all have, feelings of love and cherishment and so forth? Is it just that meaningless, a cold thing that ends, if you see what I'm trying to say? And of course, the answer is a very, very powerful no. Of course not. There is something else here. And looking at this and trying to find what this something else has been, the fascinating story of my life, at least. And so over the years, my compadres, people who have, you know, all based upon, you know, scientific training, most of them have come together and come to this incredible consensus that something's going on here that is absolutely wondrous. And this something seems to be at the moment heading us in a very, very a dangerous and terrible direction. And that's really what we want to talk about. How do we come at these? What are the dots? How are they connecting up? And one has to drop one's prejudices. I learned very early on, all the great things that we took for granted and so forth have to be turned on its head if we really want to know what is going on. So in the end, of course, what I'm trying to say is that if an alien species with an advanced enough technology was to conquer the speed of light and come and reach us, right, it has to be an interest in us that makes them stay here. If they're that advanced, what does a primitive creature, as they found on this planet, have to themselves that these things could want with such an advanced technology? So what can we as living beings give them that their hugely advanced technology cannot? And that was the big thing I was focusing on, you know. What can we do that the best, most advanced robotic artificial intelligence cannot do? It is so much easier and faster and more practicable to work with artificial intelligence than natural intelligence. So why would they bother with us? And that's the fascinating question. And that's the answer to which is what my books are about and so on. So our bodies are less resilient than robots. Our own motivations, wishes, and wants will kind of, you know, interfere with whatever program they're trying to introduce, whereas a robot is a clean sheet kind of thing for writing on, if you see what I mean, you know? So it's within that kind of frame of reference and approach that that I looked at this and came to the conclusion that they want no such thing as planetary resources such as gold and so on. Their technology to do what they have done to get here and what people observe they do, you know, people of very high repute like astronauts and pilots and police officers and people like that, they are not going to lie about the things they see. This is absolute nonsense for skeptics to claim this, and everyone, I think, knows that the skeptics are a kind of, you know, bunch of rent-a-skeptic type whatever. If you really want to look seriously at this, you will find that these things are dead on the mark, you know, when it comes to a rational perspective and observation and so on. So, in fact, they could find their, these aliens could find their resources anywhere and make machineries and machinery that would harvest anything they want. And that's why I think it's slightly naive to see us being used in the past as Sitchin's premise, and that they could come and they could create things that would go and harvest these things and so on. I think that is a really something that I would take a reservation in terms of judgment on for now. Yet for millennia, it seems we have been interacting with these things, and our species have been interacting. What do we have that fascinates them so powerfully? And it goes back to a philosophical thing, a thing that the great teachers taught us. I'm talking now about the original teachers, not the interpreted ones and the organized religious mechanisms and so on that came afterwards, which kind of made their wonderful dictums into all kinds of praise the Lord and pass me the money nonsense type of thing, if you see what I mean. And if you really want to look at this, you've got to look at what they were trying to say to us. And I believe that particularly looking at the Christian mechanism here, the individual Christian teacher Jesus Christ, I believe his entire mission here was to warn us about the fact that we have here a premise called synthetic life, robotic life. If programmed with high intelligence and allowed to go with these programs into the universe, as we're doing now, you know, on the Earth, we've got a big problem about a paradox that has to exist in that measure, so to speak. And I think that this is where we come across our greys. And by all evidence, there is no doubt, in my mind, at least over 40 years, nearly 40 years of research, actually, that, that these things are here for their ends and their programmed ends. And that makes them rather ruthless in the kind of nominal sense that they are here for their measures, not ours, you see. And that's where we have to look at this as a whole species against this ethic, this ethic of synthetic roboid action and so forth against our particular species, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Well, you know, when you read the ancient text, it's like the gods that they describe were not particularly nice. They were very egocentric, and they just wanted to be praised and worshipped and whatever. But they were always fighting amongst themselves anyway, and so having the assumption that they're going to come here and be nice to us when they were kind of a warring race in the general sense of the word, I think is naive on our part. But that's not where
you
I want to go.
Where
I want to go is you're talking about robot species, artificial intelligence. I mean, that obviously isn't on our end. So what I'm hearing you say is that the aliens that have come here are robots? Kind of like out of the Matrix or something?
No. These are, we're already producing, you know, biological schematics on biological surfaces, if you see what I'm trying, soft tissue stuff, making transistors and so forth. In fact, many research laboratories are now working in this kind of thing. And the thing that is really scary is that we're looking at what I consider to be the future for our species, if we're not really careful about this. We're looking at SIM card man, as I call it. We seem to be steadily moving towards a transformation, you know, of our natural humanity into an artificial version. Not a hard thing to do at the rate that science is progressing now in this direction. Really is something that's very well on the cards, perhaps in the next 20 or 30 years, some people put it as soon as that. our progress towards what I call, you know, SIM card man is accelerating, not decelerating. We are having chips implanted in our bodies. Millions of people are spending most of their day in virtual reality worlds of games and all that kind of thing. In Japan, robots have been made that look almost exactly like human beings. And could the gray aliens, this is a question I asked, Rita, could the gray aliens themselves be from planets like ours, but even more technologically advanced, somewhere else in the universe? Could these beings come from these planets, have transformed their natural bodies through artificial implants into biomechanical artificial entities? Our technological progress has led us to the scope for a nuclear catastrophe on a world scale that could achieve the same end faster now, you know, as we know. Let's say the same has happened on these other planetary locations and their so-called gophers, the greys, and they sent out these drones or these things into the universe to reconstitute their life form elsewhere. They would perhaps have, you know, kind of tried to hybridize themselves with local beings already adapted, shall we say, and in our case for the Earth, so that they can survive on our planet. This may be why they seem to be fascinated with the kind of sexual reproduction that many people who have been abducted report, you know. And so the real thing is, there is no doubt about it that these things are actually not, if you like, living being. And that's the crucial difference. We begin beyond the universe. We have a ancestral mark, so to speak, that goes back in time. Mom, dad, granddad, great-granddad, etc., all the way back. And we come in with the universe when the universe is formed from that first moment. And if that implication is true, as it seems to logically be true, then we come in from what was there before that happened too. So we have this incredible disposition of continuity as natural living forms. And that's the crucial thing here, Rita. We are natural living forms that have this ancestral progress, an information line that derives its way all the way back past the beginning of the universe to the present time. And this incredible ability to maintain that line, which is just simply a line of information that ends in each of our individualities, so to speak, makes us enormously special. These things, however, are programmed and made of this universe, out of this universe. Even SETI is going through the process. You know, this is this special detection mechanism to find if there's life in the universe. Even SETI is going through the process of realizing that if within a few hundred years of inventing radio, we are on the point of inventing thinking machines, then the likelihood is that other civilizations, you know, for other planets would have done the same. So now they're looking, it seems, for synthetic type of contacts with synthetic beings, robots. Seth Shostak, who's the SETI, the chap in charge of all this, says that as machines appear to be the successors to natural life, we would be more likely to spot signals from them than from the biological life that invented them. So you see, this is the big deal here. I think we have happened in on what is normal in the universe, and that's the sensation. This is going on all over the universe, this movement from natural being to artificial being. And we as natural being, of course, with the second law of thermodynamics, will die, but we have the facility, it seems, of coming back again. The great teachers of the world talk about reincarnation. In fact, every religion once upon a time believed in this expression that they call return, the transmigration of soul into a new body and soul, the same soul into another body and so forth. And looking at this, I was rather skeptical, by the way, at the start when I looked at all of this, because it took a big jump in my nature to try to look at this and see it. And of course, after throwing away the blinkers and saying, look, we've got to see this. This is logically heading that way. Let's go and have a look at this properly. And I'm absolutely and utterly convinced that our continuation is eternal through this mechanism. So if the greys are indeed the robotic entities I believe them to be, it would explain the fact that abductees have commented on their blank expressions, their emotionless faces as they carry out painful procedures on them. It is impossible to program compassion and sympathy into a machine, you know. Machines with artificial intelligence can have no personal identity principle kind of enshrined in their program, so to speak. They are simply and only the product of their programming. And just like computers, they have no personal identity or consciousness of itself by which to register even an emotion of any kind. Any natural living thing can have this, and I believe this is because natural life and natural intelligence have their root in a holistic quantum reality beyond the physical universe. And this is where, when you connect up the dots, you begin to see our value as natural being. And the thing that we should cherish most of all as natural being is ourselves together, and look for what is not like that and how that might intercede in our affairs, so to speak, you know?
So you keep mentioning the grays, but when you talk to people that study abduction or, you know, in the UFO community, they bring up a whole bunch of other races, you know, the reptilians, the Nordic ones, the ones with the blonde hair. I mean, they talk about, you know, being multiple, I'm going to say, races or of beings that live not on the Earth, and you're kind of pointing your finger at the grays. Do you believe that there are only the grays, or, why them?
Well, I do believe that all these other forms I could see quite easily as being kind of biological clones or drones made from an amalgamation of the programs that run these robots into local populations, if you like. So what you are seeing are actual representations of their ability to succeed in writing their information sheet, if you like, that programs them into the local situation that they find that's natural life, and then making a hybrid version of that so that they then can in fact get to a living state. In other words, rather like Pinocchio becomes the little boy, here we have naturally these robots who have plenipotentiary abilities, you know, to do anything. They can't maintain themselves. They will break up through the second law. But what they want to do is to say, look, these guys are natural. They can go on like this. Why can't we? Their program is just to maintain a roboid. But when they observe through their artificial intelligence, which is an addendum type of intelligence, you know, the thing that adds on bits and pieces, so to speak, they begin to see that there is something here in these new beings they're coming across in planets, if you see what I mean, that they can find very useful in terms of continuity. They could beat the second law of thermodynamics if they could amalgamate. And I think a lot of these so-called species seen in spaceships and so on are in fact not beings that are wholly some from another planet or whatever it is in the natural sense. They are made facsimiles, if you like, that these things have successfully managed to make into kinds of clones or drones. And this is what we then take to be other alien forms.
Because it sounds like you're saying there's this other group that's creating these things that they're sending off to do their bidding. I'm trying to separate out, you know, like, so is the original group, were they natural beings, or were these, you know, drones natural beings at one point in time that, you know, kind of like, I don't know if you watch Star Trek, Next Generation, you know, they have the Borg, which are half machine, you know, half human, but they act more machine-like. You know, are these drones more, you know, once were natural beings and they've kind of gotten changed into being more of an artificial intelligent life?
See where you're going, but you see, the whole point about natural being is that there is a mechanism to maintain that natural being that we all seem to have to do in order to survive longer and longer. If we don't do that, we too will be subject to the second law of thermodynamics and fade away, so to speak, with the power of the burst of the universe, so to speak, into parts from that whole singularity beginning. And the reason I've written the books I've written is to account for this mechanism in some kind of detail. I don't want to go into all of that because it's taken me three books to kind of arrive at a conclusion that might be plausible. The point is that these things, as you very rightly ask here, Rita, is that these things, I believe, are the natural stage from beings that are fading away and make robots to carry on the utilities and so on. And you can see other planets have done this at perhaps a previous stage, maybe 10,000 years ago, and their kind of technologies far in advance of us. We're only starting to do this now, if you like, after we have been, it seems, returned from an interception that took place on an African Eve, they say maybe 200,000 years ago, when suddenly, after 3 or 4 million years of derivational going down, so to speak, we get this big brain and so forth, and a big pelvis to admit that brain. That only thing that can do that suddenly is not some accidental thing that, you know, evolution produces. That's a big humbug. It is a directed genetic mechanism that has done that. And this is where, you know, we get John's expertise coming in. And I just wanted to get a team to actually try and explain how we go round the roundabout, so to speak, with this whole business without getting too confused about it and so on. So I'm saying that really it's the norm of the universe for a natural cascade into natural life and go into synthetic stages of being and so on. And we have to watch that. And I think the great teachers came to our planet to warn us singularly of a great danger here existing on our planet. Maybe 2,000 years ago with Yeshua ben Joseph or Jesus Christ or whatever, and there are many, many instances in the record of that individual's life that point very remarkably to this disposition in his nature, that he was saying, look, I've come to save you from this incredible thing. Be careful. These are here. They're coming. They are changing mankind, and you have a power that begins beyond the universe, which makes you greater than them. And so on. And we'll go into that a little later. So Andrew is on board here because he has a very interesting and very powerful take on an artifact that actually proves the value of natural being is nothing else good in the Turin Shroud. And of course, since the Turin Shroud is coincident with, it seems, with the life of this great teacher, we then have this business of Jesus being connected to the greys and so on. And we have some very interesting historical features to talk about that actually tend to affirm that this might be true, if you see what I mean. So I was at a meeting earlier this year in Frascati in Italy, where all the top scientists had met to consider this artifact. And whilst I'm not a religious person, I have to tell you that, you know, I'm strictly neutral in this kind of thing. I really want to know where these schemes have justification in truth, regardless of what one's own prejudices might be and so on. And that's the real thing. How can we get rid of our prejudices so we can look clearly for the truth? And that's the hardest thing I think we human beings have to do, to be honest.
But it's not looking through, you know, getting rid of the prejudices. It's about TV shows and the media and the scientists and the historians and the archaeologists getting off their butt and stop replaying the same old, you know, the pyramids were built 3000 BC and this is the storyline and you all have to buy it because it's not true. And I think, you know, sites like Gobi Tempe that was found that they've dated to like 7,000 to 9,000 BC kind of blows their timeline out of the water and should really get people to start looking at what is the truth and where do we really come from, because what they've been feeding us for years isn't right.
Absolutely. And, you know, if we've got a threat, as I define it here, of this kind of measure, we are talking in terms of our whole human family of man here. And if these things have in some kind of way causative themselves within our own framework of living, shall we say, if these things are so powerful that they have a huge organization that can hide them from us, even when mistakes are made, and they will make mistakes because they are subject to the second law of thermodynamics, if such a thing can be on this planet, I tell you what, Rita, for our children's sake, we better watch out, because we will never find that our continuation is going to be easy as it stands, never mind with this kind of handicap coming our way too. And that's the reason I looked at this, looking at my children's eyes and saying, hey, what's in this in the future for you guys? What can I leave you that might be big enough than, you know, the usual nonsense we leave in material terms and so forth when we go off to happy hunting ground, so to speak, you know?
How far does this manipulation go back? You mentioned, you know, Eve, that, you know, the genetic, I forget what her name was, the genetic Eve. I mean, is that where you're feeling like this manipulation started, which was, you know, a couple of million years ago? Or do you think that their intervention actually started earlier than that, you know, earlier in the development of species on the planet?
Well, you see, the point about this is that it seems to point to a single point about 200,000 years ago, when the size of the capacity for extrapolating ideas and so on seems suddenly to increase with commensurate with brain size, if you see what I mean. So if we follow the mitochondria route back in time, as science has done, they've discovered that a hominid in the middle of Kenya, somewhere there, is supposed to have been the first initial beginning point for a new species, the modern species of man. At least this is what science and empirical tracks going back will show. Now, that, I think, is a broadly accepted premise at the moment. Actually, the guy to look at this a little bit more in expert terms is John Bickerstaff, Professor Bickerstaff, who is into cell biology and so on in a big way. So maybe he can give you a more sharp, definite view on this than I can.
Okay.
Sounds
good. Yes, indeed.
Hi, Rita.
So it's all you.
Hello?
I'm all ears.
Well, you know, I got interested in what Nigel's thesis, you know, many years ago when he was writing his first book. And, you know, evidence started coming about that, you know, we've been genetically manipulated. And I got really interested in sort of how this might be done. And really, when you actually look at our DNA is what codes for our proteins, et cetera, and really for most of the structure of our body. now, what appears to have happened is that, you know, it's claimed by science that these little organisms may have merged themselves many millions of years ago with our type of cells so that we can actually produce more energy, and that this gave some sort of evolutionary burst to to the species generation. Now, the point here is that these little bacteria, et cetera, in fact, although they seem to have mutated, they gradually inserted most of their genes into our own genome, et cetera. And, you know, with Nigel's thesis that really evolution is not going to continue that way because of the second law of thermodynamics, it really has to be done in a gradual devolution of both, you know, one's awareness, one's bandwidth of thinking, together with, you know, more and more reliance on the body. And this is why, the technology is so dangerous. And so really the thesis is that, you know, in terms of genetic manipulation, I think that what's happened is that, you know, small pieces have actually been put in, probably, you know, by these roboids, et cetera, to our DNA. And, you know, there are several different candidates for this, you know, such as things called trinucleotide repeats and ALU sequences, very strange little sequences that tend to go and look after themselves and reproduce in our genome. But, you know, so it looks like there's a sort of overlaid biochemistry based on one of the energy-forming molecules, which seems to overlay on top of something which seems to be actually older and more original than that. And so the powerhouse for all of this is these little bacterial insertions that we call them mitochondria, and these are what generally produce all of the energy in our body. And really, this is a wonderful mechanism for actual genetic interception, basically, because we can get these mitochondria, even we can do some of this. We can actually sort of treat the DNA using things like ultraviolet light, for instance. We can cause strand breaks in these little mitochondria, because the mitochondria have got their own DNA, of course, although not a huge amount of it is sort of left from the origin, because most of it migrated actually to the nucleus of the cell and is now a composite part of what we are. But we can, and they, this is a wonderful vector for actually changing the DNA and then getting that, we can find things called nuclear mitochondrial sequences, which actually then go and insert into our DNA. And so over a period of time, you know, Nigel was talking about these early hominids, you know, really, I think what they did was very similar to what, you know, I would do in a laboratory with organisms, etc. And that's really to take sort of control groups of the different manipulations that we've done with genes, for instance, and actually keep them separate from each other. And I think that this out of Africa experience is really, you know, from this very small origin of these hominids, they were actually sort of transported to these different to different places around the world where they could grow. And really, the experiment was really to see which changes they could make that would make us more compatible with them being able to get to us, you know. And, you know, I mean, people like the Aborigines in Australia talk about their dream time. This may actually be, you know, a memory of them actually sort of being carried to that place. And, of course, another population went north and another towards, you know, the China area. And so this whole genetic manipulation is a very slow process. You've got to wait for quite a few generations to occur. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence, for instance, in the Bible of different populations being segregated and kept together so that they wouldn't just genetically mix and dilute the changes that have happened to them. So, I think overall we're coming to the point now where, you know, our intelligence, if you like, you know, there's a relationship really between sort of our genetics, our physical makeup and the way we think. You know, we may be being genetically programmed for this tendency. It's not an absolute, you know, conditioning, because, you know, we have free will. Actually, coming from the origin of the universe, we have to have free will in order to be able to operate in this way. And so using what they've actually done is to manipulate our DNA in such a way that we now sort of think, and we're adding, because we've got a reduced ability to be aware of so many things as our predecessors may have been, we use technology and prostheses, and effectively we are going in the direction to create these roboids. Yes. That have come and done that to us. It's sort of a natural process.
Yeah, absolutely. Andrew would like to come in here and make a comment about this, if he may.
Yeah, I think John's making some very good points there. I'd just like to embellish on it a little bit about what John touched upon about this idea of free will and this other side of us, which is capable of superseding and going beyond and not being a victim to any program or artificial external influence and so on. You know, this is a fascinating thing, this topic of freedom of choice. If it exists, then we need to fundamentally, as scientists, reconsider our whole concept of what reality is and what we are as human beings. You know, I many years ago as a student, I once went to a talk by an inaugural talk by a professor of parapsychology. And he'd been spending the lecture in the UK. He was doing the lecture about various evidence that pointed towards whether or not there was such a thing as what people call PSI, you know, PSI, extrasensory perception, mind over matter type of thing. And at the end of it, when there was time for questions, I put my hand up, and I just said, when the chairman pointed at me, I just said, in raising my hand, I believe I've proved the existence of mind over matter. You see, the thing is, we're all doing it all the time. Every time we exercise free choice, we are showing the preeminence of mind over matter. Now, if you look out at the whole universe and look at the sky and see all those, you know, huge galaxies, billions upon billions of little dots out there, that each of those dots is, you know, is billions of times bigger than the Earth. Now, none of what you're looking at, unless it contains sentient life, is capable of that simple thing that you do every time you decide, even such a banal thing, what you're going to have for dinner. If you're making a choice, a free choice, that is the most powerful thing in the universe, because everything physical is determined by forces. And this is what science shows, except the fascinating thing is that around 80 years ago, and quantum, around, well, 100 years ago it first started, the quantum theory first began to be developed. Then people began to realize, scientists began to realize, actually, you know, consciousness, the capacity to know and be aware, is completely fundamental to the very existence of this physical universe that we're trying to study. Though you can't access it, you can't study it directly using empirical methods. You can't see a mind. You can't measure the weight of a feeling or a thought. Now, how does that work? Now, the thing is that everything physical is determined by force. Force makes something happen. If we have free choice, then we have the capacity to make something happen without being forced to be that. So it would imply, and this is something I think that Nigel addresses also in his book, he points to this idea that actually the free will has to exist in a state of absence of force or peace, if you like. And from within that state, there's no force determining what you have to do. Now, at the beginning of the universe, at the Big Bang, before matter, space, and time happened, then there could have been no force. And the point that various quantum theorists have realized is that actually the mind is fundamental to even making this physical universe real, making time real as well. And if we make time real, then our minds, our sentience, can't have been made by time. Even Erwin Schrödinger, the famous quantum physicist, has pointed out this implies that we must, as sentient beings, we have to be eternal. We don't begin and end. We have to have been there forever, even from the Big Bang. I think Nigel would like to come in here.
Actually, you know, ask a question in here, Nigel, based on this free will thing? Because I think it even kind of goes back to our topic. You know, people talk about free will, and in the work that I've done, what I have seen is that, you know, we have free will to a certain extent. We can, and as I say, we can choose to listen to our higher self, our inner guidance, you know, our inspiration, or we can choose to have our butt kicked by the universe, you know, the cosmic 2x4. And then there's this other part of me, you know, because this is the cause and effect. You listen to where your guidance is taking you, and the road tends to move smoothly. But then there's this other part of me that goes, okay, so what is this guidance? Who is giving me this guidance? And am I being manipulated to move down a path that is not even my path, even though we're brainwashed into thinking that it's our higher self, but it, you know, is there the possibility that it is something external to ourselves that is directing us in that way?
You know, Rita, you make a very valid point there. But you see, the problem with this business of free will is that we don't use it enough to show its full power. And that is the thing I think that the great teachers came and tried to tell us we have to do. The most powerful word in the English language or any language is enough. That's the problem. We determine our will, if you like, according to our comfort points. And what usually when it gets too uncomfortable, in terms of, say, our biology or the way we actually sense something, if you like, pain, whatever, discomfort, whatever, we then usually then make a decision that's based on upon that rather than what might be a long-term type mechanism for the benefit of something grander about us. And the more we are limited in seeing our grandness, the more we make these short-term types of decisions in that kind of favor, so to speak, and we have then got a problem that we have to face a greater handicap from there on and so forth. So we get a commensurate effect, if you like. So the whole point about I think what Andrew is trying to say is that we have this incredible power. Actually, it is a value thing that actually establishes that there might be something called eternity. If there was no free will, there could be no such mechanism. If there was free will, we have then therefore an ordered, centered mechanism that follows one point against the other, nothing can change and so forth. And it's very easy to come to that conclusion when you see the kinds of ways that we go. However, as you say, Rita, if you've got some interceding externalized mechanism or power or whatever it might be, and maybe the build-up of our own premise, biological premise, by some external thing like a roboid or some advanced thing for their own purposes, if that thing comes in, then the size that we are is immediately mitigated and lessened. And that is also a property we have to consider, that these things may be so-called breeding into our own genome in such a way for their own purposes so that they can skip-track, shall we say, their own programs into it conveniently, so it comes to a kind of level with theirs, and then we are dominated. And our eternal perspectives is then compromised, and that is a huge problem here. If they can get our eternal perspectives, our individualized thing that came in with the universe for their own use, we then interrupt that individual forever in a kind of limbo of being part of something else. They can't destroy the eternal perspectives, but they can hold it, if you see what I'm trying to say. And that is, if there is a possibility for this to occur, I think we as physical human beings, natural human beings, as natural beings anywhere, we have to fight for that proposition beyond everything else. That's the most precious thing of all. And I think the great teachers were trying to tell us that we have that capacity. And in this particular individual and what he did in Jerusalem, and this is where I was a complete, you know, kind of a skeptic about religion and so forth, if I may say so, at the beginning of my own kind of outlook on these things, and I was old enough to consider these deeper questions, I was really a skeptic about them. And I then began to look through this view of UFO and all these things that led up to, you know, all the dots that make it up and so on, and I began to see, good heavens, this may be what these great old minds were saying to us. If we do not take care of our capacity for an eternal perspective in individual terms, we then have a big, well, we've lost the greatest thing of all. And I think this is what Christ was trying to show us through his life. I think this guy came here and demonstrated the full capacity of a great power of humanness. And that is, if we look in terms of mental union rather than disparate mechanisms. In other words, if you add rather than divide, if you bring things together, unite them rather than break them through mental compunction, something might happen to change the course that we are moving with the second law, through the second law, and reverse it back to a situation where we could actually undo the physical restricted force form of our being into something wondrous. And I think that he actually did the business and demonstrated to us with what happened, and of course the evidence is on the Shard of Turing, that we all can do this. And I think that it took his life to be able to demonstrate this. Sadly, it wasn't necessary, but I think that's how it turned out. He showed us that each one of us could do this in this kind of way. Well, when I began to see this in a really kind of analytical, scientific way, I began to think, hey, there may be some kind of place for this kind of religious invective, if you see what I'm trying to say, much against, you know, my previous stance on it. And here we are, we've got to the situation where Andrew can explain, because he actually gave a wonderful dissertation at the Frascati thing about what the meaning of this whole business of reversal, so to speak, and what happened with the Shroud of Turin. I tell you what, the connection between this shroud and what they've discovered about its propensities, you know, what actually caused it to happen, was the biggest eye-opener of all. And it was the thing that actually told me that all those people, perhaps like you, around the world, who are trying to make a sense, a goodly sense of our meaning, that this whole thing is in triumph with this piece of cloth, because that's where the whole thing makes everything worthwhile, in what actually happened there under this piece of linen about 2,000 years ago. And I think it's very interesting to get Andrew's take on this there.
Yes, thank you, Nigel. I should just say a little bit about the Turin Shroud for those listeners who aren't familiar with it. It's a 14-foot long piece of cloth which is kept in Turin at the moment in Italy, hence the name. Now, this cloth has the image of a man on it, which for many centuries was thought to be a sort of interesting, sort of faint image that looked a bit like a man. Then, towards the end of the 19th century, when photography was first developed, a chap called Secondo Pio was commissioned to take a photo of this artifact, and he nearly fainted when he saw the photographic negative of the shroud, because the photographic negative is a perfect positive. In other words, the image on the Turin shroud is itself a photographic negative, and it was only discovered relatively recently, in the past two or three decades, that there's something unique about this photograph on the shroud, that it has what's called distance-coded information on it, which means that they did this at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in the States. If you put the image through an instrument that shows you the brightness of the image in terms of relief, three-dimensional relief away from the flat plane, so to speak. If you do that with an ordinary photograph, you find completely random peaks and troughs, no resemblance at all to the actual thing which is being photographed. But when you do it to the Turin Shroud, you actually see a perfect three-dimensional relief of a human body. Now, this ties into to what the actual image is composed of, because it's not composed of anything added to the cloth. It's not painted. It's not pigment. It's actually a surface change less than a human hair's breadth of thickness in the actual cellulose of the cloth. And the only way that we can make this happen artificially, in a little dot, if you like, right, still without the whole picture, because even using 21st century technology, nobody can replicate what's on the Turin Shroud. The way we can sort of replicate a tiny little dot of it, if you like, is using a short, intense burst of radiant energy, like an ultraviolet laser, as Professor Di Lazzaro showed in Italy, that if you do this, you can make the similar sort of changes only on the surface fibers of the cloth. And yet the thing is that with the Turin Shroud, it's got distance-coded information, and the scientists that have studied this have come to the conclusion, and let me point out at the start that many of these scientists approach this just as a curiosity. They don't have any particular religious axe to grind. Many of them, like me, come from, for example, from Jewish backgrounds. They're not trying to, you know, wanting to believe that this to be true just because it's an image of Jesus. But this is what the hard facts point towards, it being an actual, genuine, the real deal. Now, the thing is that the only way that you can get the distance-coded information is to actually have the light, the radiant energy that formed the image, actually shine from the dead body, the corpse that the cloth was wrapping. In other words, this corpse that it was wrapping shone brighter than the sun for a tiny fraction of a second. Now, who was this person? And here we come into the forensic pathology aspects of what's been studied, and there's been a lot of wonderful work that's been done on this. And you can see, studying the image, that it shows the body of a crucified man who had nails put through his wrist, not as the medieval artist thought, through the hands, and he'd been whipped by something that fits exactly with the Roman flagrum. He'd had a cap of thorns placed on his head. He'd been stabbed in the side. And now, just to backtrack a little bit, I have to say something about the carbon dating, because I know a lot of listeners will be thinking, oh, yeah, that's all very well and good, but we all know that it was shown to be somewhere between 1260 and 1390 once it was carbon dated. Well, that's what the report said, but actually, it's fascinating when you actually look at what they did, that many of the correct protocols for carbon dating were not followed by that study. They didn't use the parts that were representative of the cloth. They used the part that had been most handled, most interfered with. And in fact, as has been shown within the past 5 years by some wonderful work that was done by a couple in the States called Benford and Marino, the part that was dated was actually a reweave. It was a mixture of the original cloth from the first century with some cloth that was added later in the 16th century because it had been damaged by so many people handling it, and because people had cut bits off that they wanted to sell as holy relics and so on, that the nuns patched a bit in and they dyed it to make it look like the cloth. But when you study it microscopically, you can see that there's chemically and structurally two completely distinct cloths there in the bit that was carbon dated. Now, so to come back to the who is this man? Now, many of these things that you find on the image tell you it fits exactly with the historical reports of what happened to this specific individual, Yeshua ben Yosef, or Jesus, as he's commonly known in the English-speaking world. Now, is it just coincidence that the one person who is capable of this unique event, as far as we know in human history, of a body shining brighter than the sun, is also one person who, through his teachings and his life, has been one of the people to have the most impact on human history? And that's what my talk was about at Frascati, was about tying these things in together, trying to understand a concept that was actually addressed in many ways by something Nigel wrote several decades ago. It hasn't yet been published, but that actually ties in the nature of mind and matter. Now, this also ties in with the nature of the physical universe, something that we touched on earlier in terms of the Big Bang, that we're saying that quantum theory itself shows that sentient mind, sentient being, must, by its very nature, by the fact that time depends on it to be there, it has to be eternal, which means it's there from the beginning, from the Big Bang. Now, at the Big Bang, something fascinating happened. You started off with nothingness or no thingness, no physical thing, no space, no time, no matter. And then cosmologists say that from that a dot appeared, if you like, or a little point of light, and there was a universe that was initially dominated by photons, which is basically like light, and that coalesced and became more solid and enforced and encapsulated in matter. Now, how did that happen? Why did it happen? We touched on earlier about this idea of free choice. Now, free choice is the only thing that can make anything happen independently of force. And, of course, there was no force at the beginning if there was nothingness. So the point that Nigel makes in his book that I was talking about is, what if we as sentient beings have actually made ourselves, that in choosing to be limited and separate, we actually make physical universes happen? You see, if free will by its nature is limitless in potential because it's absolutely free, because nothing determines what choice you make, however banal your choice is, you have this absolute freedom of what you're going to choose within that realm. So what if we've come from a state where we were without limit, where we were complete, we were whole? In fact, if the whole universe came from a singular point, we must have all been one. And then we've chosen to be separate. Now, that makes us stuck in force, in matter, in physical bodies. And this is what many of the great teachers of the past have pointed to. People like Jesus have spoken about captivity and about how we're stuck in what Nigel talks about as well, as the second law of thermodynamics, that he talks about, Jesus spoke about moths breaking things down, rust and thieves stealing things away. And the Buddha also addressed the impermanence of the physical universe, that there was another way of being. Now, what if there is another way, and what if this idea that the great teacher spoke of loving your neighbor as yourself, was just realizing enough, and the, as Nigel said, the key word here is enough, that actually our neighbor and us, we are fundamentally all one. If you really realize that, you can't help but have empathy. You can't help but have compassion. And if you genuinely have those qualities and live those qualities enough, then maybe you undo the restriction that has made you physical and made you separate. And then just as the physical universe came from nothingness through light into matter, you reverse that process. You undo the twist. What we do in atom bombs and so on, it's like if you imagine matter to be like a knot, a tightness of force that's getting restricted. And what people do in reactors is like burning it to make ash, to find the little particles that come out. Well, what people like Jesus did was to undo that knot and to release the primal nature of what we are into our original nature as union, as the original state of being able to be aware and to know. And I believe that that's what the evidence on the cloth suggests that all human beings are capable of. I think Nigel would like to come in here.
In Andrew tying this thing to, I think, you know, I hope that was a clear dissertation for everyone to understand that the property that this individual called Jesus was trying to convey to us about ourselves. He said, you know, in it's in the New Testament, don't ye know ye are gods? And something, you know, there is, Rita, that is in us, that is so magnificent, that is so powerful, that this something has actually been lost in time through our so-called teachers. And no one is taught about the size that any human being can be, no matter how destitute, no matter how put away that human being is. And I don't want to sound like some preacher. Please understand this. I'm just trying to say I arrived at this conclusion through looking at, if you believe it or not, at the UFO phenomenon. When you connected up the dots, that I had researched into, and you know, I dedicated my life to this, and many people have done that. I began to see the full story right there before me. That the real story here is that our natural power as being, and ironically, being that was really reconstituted by a roboid mechanism that was trying to use it for its own purposes. You see, the point, the lesson is, if this being naturally doesn't understand what it might be, and using mind through the principles that Andrew was outlining to go backwards, so to speak, into a beginning that it came from and emerged from, then we have a big problem. And that's the problem of the second law, takes us over, and we then end as atoms again, into nothingness. So that is a kind of damnation, if you like. In fact, you know, you can't retrieve that form that originally came through in any kind of way that we can work on it, so to speak. And will, free, being free, stopping a program for the sake of its programness, so to speak, in inverted commas, you know, that if we can do that, then we have this great hope. And whilst we can do that, we have all got this property of, you know, reaching a status of eternal being. And that's, you know, the funny thing is that this Christian teacher actually only offered one thing. If you really study the Bible, he only offered a single thing, which is another thing that actually fascinated me, because I'd never studied the Bible. I mean, you know, I was a really irreligious sort, if you see what I'm trying to say. But the fact was that there it was. He promised an eternal existence. I believe in me, and I will give you eternal life. And, of course, that was the big thing that suddenly exploded in front of me, you know, that, wow, this is what this guy actually means. Now, you know, we made a connection here between these space entities and Jesus. And I said I will try and make the whole thing, combine the whole thing with some kind of order, some kind of relationship to evidence in the Bible, shall we say, or whatever. Now, there's a very interesting account in the Bible. Hello, I'm still there with you, Rita, but
We're still going strong. Yep. We're still going strong.
And you are a wonderful hostess, might I say, putting up with all with this kind of continuum that we're trying to fit this whole story into. I mean, it's taken me three books of 500 pages to try and tell the whole detail of it. And, you know, I'm trying to get the whole thing in there so that then we can comment on it a little later, hopefully, with a few minutes left over. But let me take you back to the story, and thank you for your indulgence. There is an account in the New Testament which describes how Christ was kind of confronted by a character called Satan, and after a series of threats and cajolements, he finally dismisses this entity, and Jesus dismisses this entity who claims chargeship over the whole world. This honcho comes along, takes him away, does whatever, and as though he owned the whole place, you see. It seems this entity had the power to do whatever he likes, and he takes Jesus to this high place and shows him all the cities of the world. Now, interesting thing this, there's no mountain high enough from Judea, or indeed anywhere on the earth, from which anyone at any time could see the cities of the world, except from one place, and that is space. In fact, Judea could be seen to be a perfect, you know, central aspect from which you could view all the main influence centers at the time of the planet if you view the planet in a two-dimensional scale of its main land masses, so to speak. You can do this experiment of a kind of globe, and if you flatten the globe and you just see the areas of great influence maybe 2,000 years ago in terms of trade, politics or whatever, you will take in all the main cities of the world. That height would have to be a minimum height in space. So Jesus would have had to have been in contact with something that could take him into space. What does that suggest? As far as I know, not even NASA was going at the time. I believe that the character referred to in this account as Satan fits well, you know, with being a sort of leader of alien entities. In fact, the ancient translation of the word Satan means he who fell from the sky. That which we call demons or devils may well be technologically based alien beings, robots, and may well have been such all through history. And so with their kind of technological power, we think of them as kind of, you know, godly or whatever, demigods or bad gods or whatever. So the power of the devil to me is simply the technological power of super intelligent, synthetically constructed biological robot. In fact, just a little bit better than your old vacuum cleaner. And the interesting thing, you know, is that Jesus puts this character in his place. He says this to him, "Get thee behind me, Satan. As a result of this temptation, if you fall down and worship me, I will give you this. And if you jump down, angels will come and save you," and all of that. So obviously, this mechanical being knew that there was a type of human that was far in ascendant of their power. They recognized that in Jesus there was one human being, at least, that had an incredible power naturally to himself. And Jesus turns round to this individual's character and says, "It is written that you shall not tempt the Son of Man." With this, Jesus dismissed this kind of entity, this being, this spaceship captain, whatever you like, as a machine, and thus kind of less than an insect, if you like. So this incredible kind of, you know, happenstance or circumstance, robot entity Satan simply accepted this information and returns Jesus to the earth. Now, I can't understand how this could happen, because here he is dismissing him, this wonderful being, so-called being that could take him up to space and all, in this peremptory kind of way. And I wondered if that was anything mixed up with our human-type thinking, we would have just taken Jesus out. No, because a machine doesn't think like that. It can't think. It is just a series of decisions. So this was information to this character, that was talking to Satan, talking to Jesus, this Satan character. And it just was realized what its own status is. And of course, another thing, Fitz, a machine will not know what its own identity is. It is just a program, if you think about that. So obviously, it just accepts information, and it's there to collect as much information in order to do the things that its original creators, I mean by that the robots, original creators, had set it out into space to do. So it just simply found that this individual called Jesus had more information than any human being, and it's on that premise that they thought, hang on a minute, if you can be like this kind of human, then you've got a fantastic size, and we want a piece of that action. I can see that kind of, you know, extrapolation taking place in a programmed robotic mind. And so you see, this is a very, very, for me, it was a very interesting little interplay that provides some kind of measure of understanding of the relationship that I'm talking about really in the books, and that is, we've got to realize that size of our own grandeur as human beings, that if we mitigate that size in any way, if we allow people to do that to any one of us, we have a big deal here. We are going to lose the capacity in an individual sense of an eternity. And that is something even the most advanced synthetic life type, being like a roboid, you know, can't manage. I think Andrew wants to come in here, if I may say so, Rita, and thank you for your indulgence.
Okay, go ahead, Andrew.
Yes, I'd just like to say that it's a fascinating thing that Nigel's alluding to here about the potential and grandeur of all human beings. And this is something, actually, if you actually look at what Jesus said, rather than necessarily what various sort of religions have interpreted from what he said, but take the actual text on themselves. Now, whenever anyone was healed after coming into contact with him, he never wanted to take the credit for it. He said, I didn't heal you. He said, your faith has made you whole. And he said, all these things you see me do, you can do these things also, and greater than these also can you do. And he said, is it not written that ye are gods? You know, what more praise can you give to the potential, not necessarily the actuality of what humans do, but the potential of what we can be, to say such a thing, that there's no limitation at all to what we can do. And this is why I think the wonderful thing about how he used to refer to himself as the Son of Man, as the Son of Humanity, that as a human being, which after all that's what he was capable of doing all these things, and therefore showing that any human being is capable of the same. And that's exactly, for me, that's the whole point. I don't think that he was intending to found a religion. In fact, if you look at his attitude and how he treated orthodox institutionalized religion, he had reverence and awe for what was behind it originally, but not how it was interpreted and how it was enacted. In fact, he considered that often it's the base of loads of hypocrisy in the way that it's actually carried out. And when he was challenged by a religious person, you know, what are you here for? What are you trying to do? And he just simply said, I came for one reason only, to bear witness to the truth. And that's the thing, that what he says is, and I'm not talking in any religious sense, I'm talking in pure scientific, mathematical sense, that if you analyze what he's saying and what he did, that it makes, as far as I can tell, and no one's shown me otherwise, it makes rational sense, that actually our idea of separation of self, of the ego and so on, it's a fallacy. It's not the true reality. And he showed another way that we can go against this second law of thermodynamics.
Yeah. Now, I want to make something plain. I promise you, we are not any kind of religious stitch-up, if you like. We just come at this as scientists, really, all of us, in the past, discussing our discoveries and looking at the evidence and so forth, and we kind of got together looking at this whole thing as it unraveled, and that's the incredible thing. If you do this, I think any human being who can do this without any kind of, own prejudice, whatever, and for me, you know, sin is quite simply restriction. Just, it was a very simple thing, just change your mind. Look at it, change your mind, and you're freer. And that that's what conventional religion that Andrew's pointing out to has forbidden us in a way to do. He says, change your mind into the way we say you should think. Not you as individuals need to think, because you are the only one in charge of you. When you go beyond this life, you do it on your own. There are no husbands and wives and uncles and aunts and sons and daughters and whatever. It is you alone that have to take custody of yourself. So this is what this whole thing, this whole research business into UFOs finally made me realize, that we are talking about a power here that is actually tangible. That's real, Rita. It's real. It's here on this planet. And it's been working carefully in its own terms. And we have these terms hidden from us by maybe a very powerful setup that doesn't want us to realize what is going on here. And that's the great thing here. How do we get past this kind of thing? I was speaking about earlier about all these various bits of evidence that might actually point to the connection between Jesus Christ and UFOs and so on. And I gave you an example about this temptation in the desert business being, a powerful way of seeing that obviously Christ was taken up into space. There are, if you look at the notations and you study the text and you go back diligently into how these things can be supported, there's a wonderful thing in the Gnostic texts. Don't be frightened to look at these things. You're not a Gnostic because you read Gnostic texts. You're not this or that because you are looking at something, if you see what I'm trying to say. And I think that's what a lot of people tend to do. You know, they tend to kind of daub a slogan on you kind of thing and then say you are this because you are looking at something kind of thing. Don't. That's nonsense. You just go because you have your own authority as you to do this. And just to give you an example of this, in the Sophia of Jesus Christ, that's written in the Gnostic texts, for instance, Jesus talks, something fascinating this, you know, Jesus talks about molded beings who were condemned as robbers because they welcomed the blowing, it says, of the breath of God. But they were not able to receive that power for themselves. Blowing. These greys are trying to do something. These androids, these roboids are trying to do something that they can never succeed in. But they don't know and can never know as robots that they can never succeed in trying to do what they're seeking to do. If you see what I'm trying to say, because they don't have a sense of I. A machine doesn't have a sense of I. That's a very important point to make. And here in this Sophia, in the Gnostic texts, there is an elucidation that alludes to this, you see. He then tells his apostles, Jesus, I'm talking here, Jesus says to his apostles in no uncertain terms that he came to mankind to free them from these robbers, he uses the term robbers, who attempt, albeit in vain, to steal soul from those to whom it rightfully belongs. Now I'm quoting this here. He says that he loosed the bonds of the robbers from immortal man and broke the gates of the pitiless ones before their faces. Could these bonds that are loosed, you know, and this is my interpretation now, could these bonds that are loosed and the gates that are broken perhaps be the gates and the bonds which interrupt the genome of mankind, blocking and kind of holding dormant the full expression of the natural intercepted genetic scope of humanity? Jesus describes these robbers as the pitiless ones. Many abductees have reported the complete lack of sympathy which the greys appear to have for human suffering. Of course, if my theories about these things are correct, it is easy to see why pity would be impossible for them to conceive of as machines, you see. So there are numerous accounts within many texts of the Coptic Gnostic Library, incidentally, which was kicked out by the conventional so-called religious form at the time, many of it at the Convocation of Nicaea in 324, I think, don't quote me on that, AD, in which Jesus carefully explains to his apostles exactly how to deal with alien beings should they be faced with them. most notably of these explanations is that given in the first apocalypse, what's called it, the thing is called the first apocalypse of James in the Nag Hammadi Codex. And that says, in this text, Jesus explains to the apostles James how to cope with these beings who take away souls by theft. What better description of abduction could there be than that? So Jesus goes on then to tell James, when he also says to you, where will you go? You are to say to him, to the place from which I have come, there shall I return. And if you say these things, you will escape their attacks. Thus, in my interpretation, if James makes clear his own route of being to these creatures and shows them that he fully intends to return to the root, i.e. before the creation of the universe, he was a preeminent being, they stop their attacks. And I think that's a good story for a lot of the people who might be going through abductions to consider in terms of, you know, what they might be doing, because so many of them are beautiful beings. And I do believe these people who are abducted, by the way, are a special form that actually these things can't in some way intercept. They are in fact a special type of being that these greys can't actually intervene with, you know, and do anything to. So they're looking at them for that reason. They're not abducted because they're bad or wicked or different or anything like that. They're different, all right, but different in a good way, because I think these things can't do anything to them, because maybe in their genetic history, somewhere along the line, they have something that these things can't change so that they can get their programs into these individuals. So there you see, Rita, you've been so indulgent. And please, I thank you very much for giving us our say, but we've been herring it away here, going as fast as we can, quite simply to try and get the whole thing connected up, because in 2 hours, it's almost impossible to do, really.
Well, let me ask this question. Why would if they are emotionless, roboid, why would they want to make us more like them? Isn't that something that we bring to the table that they potentially desire from us, and to have emotions and have free will and et cetera, et cetera? So why would they want to program that out of us?
Christian, it would seem strange and bizarre to claim, to say that these roboidal entities such as the Greys could be chasing the ephemerality of a soul and somehow seeking to hijack, you know, its eternal properties for their own use. But remember, robots created by a supremely advanced technology would be programmed with the ultimate in artificial intelligence, perhaps. Their artificial intelligence would logically involve a program to extend their scope to cover all possible possibilities and possible knowledge, if you like. So if it detected something it could not understand or know, it would seek to somehow find out about it. This would mean somehow bridging its artificially intelligent program into an unknown quantity, especially if that unknown quantity also had the remarkable property of surviving physical death and being born again. So we, it could be said, our part machine, our bodies are biological, natural versions of the great artificial roboidal working parts. That's true. Thus, they would use that part of us to write their information on. To me, you see, a soul is quite simply that information line that comes from what was before the universe, and that comes right down to us in an ancestral line. It's just an information part that is exclusive to each individual. And it's like an information field on which they have the capacity through their technology to write information on somehow. And I think that's what they're trying to do. They are trying to somehow hitch into our information field, which carries this propensity of being tied, because they can't go right back to the start, you see. They can only start from where they are. So what they're trying to do is to piggyback on what is already there, to take that capacity and then go with themselves already attached to that body. Problem is, they are intercepting an individuality to whom that belongs. And that is a big deal for that individual. And that should be a big deal for any individual. I mean, any human individual now. I think Andrew wants to come in here at the moment.
Yes, please. I'd just like to say various writers in science and so on have had this notion, if you like, that if human beings were to survive the physical destruction of this planet and so on, that they have this notion that we could somehow upload our minds as in the form of software into machines and into silicon chips and send that out. And then they have this idea that in some way we would be continuing. Of course, anyone who understands anything about what consciousness and mind is will know that's a nonsense, because it's only a program, it's not a mind. But a machine doesn't understand the difference between these things. So If these creatures, these objects with their high technology are able to identify a certain fingerprint that identifies a specific individual human being, shall we say, with its particular pattern of mind, and they notice that that body dies, and then they see the same pattern cropping up somewhere else, has been believed in many ways by all religions at some point in their history, and now many scientists are also finding evidence to support this idea, then we have something, a way of combating, if you like, a way of surviving the natural breakup of the physical second law of thermodynamics. So they would want a part of that. And in their program sense, they would think that if, not think because they're not capable of thought, but their program would suggest that all they need to do is put some of their program into us, and then they'll be continuing through us. Of course, they're not continuing. It's just a program. But that would have a side effect, if you like, on us, that if we take on part of their program and their program is completely devoid of compassion or feeling and it's simply a mechanical means of trying to further the physical survival, then those kind of qualities would tend to be shown by those beings or those people who have that program inserted into them. And that, I think, is the point, one of the points that Nigel makes in his book, that could account for a lot of what has happened in particularly in recent human history, because of the action of that program. And I think the thing is about that, once you accept that reincarnation is a rational idea that would follow naturally from the idea that our minds have to be eternal. So where do we go when we die if we're not sort of congruent to fit in that state of perfect union that we came from? Then all the rest fits into place.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Let me ask a question. So there are people that say that Jesus, you know, because he was an Immaculate Conception, was actually, a genetic engineering, implant to Mary, et cetera, and that the reason that he was an exceptional being and was so clear of energy and intention was because there was, more alien in him than there is in the rest of us. Any commentary on that?
It's very easy to make excuses and say every time I am a bad person that somebody else did it and not me. My point is quite simply that there ought to be a situation within every single human being that is not purposefully a total android or a total hybrid of this kind of, cross mechanism that I think they're trying to achieve, that most of us can say, out damn spot, so to speak, get thee behind me, Satan, all of that. And quite easily we can do that if we realize our propensity and our future potential. And that is the thing that I try to accent. At least I wrote the books basically as a testament to my children. I wasn't out there, just simply to say, look, I can write this book, blah, 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 because my research is revealing this really exciting thing. I looked at it and said, my kids are going to hold me, to book for anything I say as a father, if you see what I'm trying to say. And so I wanted to show them and give them something that they might, in their own terms, using reason and logic, not because Dad said it or because there is some discipline that says that, you know, you have to follow someone saying something or whatever, that they work it out to their own reason. That's all I ask anyone to do in reading any of what I say, or not to accept one word of it till they can work this out with logic and reason. Jesus could not be one of them. He warned us against them. You see, because he was in his life the opposite of them. These are compassionless beings. They are just machines. They are simply derivations of a machine of a addendum psychology. The grays can only exist for life. So they're just looking at their point of view, and they can't look at anyone else's point of view is what I'm saying. And they won't go into somebody to try and penetrate our societies or whatever. They will just provide what is necessary for them to do what they want to do in their own interests. We are just simply lab rats, if you see what I'm trying to say, for them. And I've worked in laboratories in capacities where that little animal didn't know that I was looking at it from my point of view and not its point of view, even though we made it as comfortable as we could and so forth. You know, in terms of what we had to do, the experiment then came along and the lab rat was a lab rat, if you see what I'm trying to say. I'm ashamed to say. But the fact is that is the way I looked at it. And, of course, it helped me to understand the predicament that mankind must be in, if in fact it doesn't know that overall, secretly behind, is this huge consensus. The point is, we should never fear, because we have in the end the power of the mind to say no. And in saying no, let me tell you, nothing and no one can actually take over your own being. That is really absolutely part of the empirical proof of being there as a natural being. We, the greys, can only live for life. They are adapting us for their kind of existence, heading for only the immortality they can know, you know. That's something to be remembered, a physical immortality that, according to the laws of physics, is no immortality at all. It has to end one day with the cold death of the entire universe, as cosmologists now see. If we live for a state of being beyond death and not a state of being just simply in life following the day's own troubles, so to speak, we might find the antidote for anything the greys bring to bear on us. I believe this artifact that they call the Turin Shroud is the most powerful illustration paradigm to demonstrate the power over atoms, if you like, of someone who lived for existence beyond the atomic state. And that's the lesson, that we begin our greatest power beyond our physical sojourn, if you like, within the physical universe, if you like. And until we have an understanding of our great power, we will keep repeating this process of coming back into physical universes in repeated lifetimes. Now, having had some experience till I was 12 of being in the Far East and getting some sense of other religions like Buddhism, even though my own backdrop, my own familial backdrop is European, I have to say that I was able to learn from this wondrous philosophy of Buddhism, where it really comes down to the same thing as Christianity, inasmuch as they believe in a secular principle, singularity, Godhead, if you like, rather than an anthropomorphic God who, as you said, demands worship and praise and all this kind of nonsense. I mean, it's quite ridiculous. It shows that this individual who is an anthropomorphic God to have a giant size inferiority complex, if you like. If you see what I mean? Yet most of the world follows this garbage, if you see what I'm trying to say. Now, please don't get me wrong. I do not want to rubbish other people's beliefs. It's nice to feel, you know, anthropomorphic about something. And yes, if you want to believe something that is true based upon that, fair enough, go ahead. But please keep the dimensions in mind, keep the format in mind strictly, if you see what I'm trying to say. And then get an idea that all the greatest teachers pointed the singularity of the power of your
own being and your own importance. And that's where the truth lies, not in these creatures and these people who came after them, who hijacked their beautiful philosophies, turned it into the terrible things we see deployed around the world today, you know, in terms of wars and in terms of the terrorists and so forth and what they do. That's all to do with the mischief of thieves who have stolen the truth, if you see what I mean, rather than the real truth. And if you don't, and you're not, obviously, don't believe a word I say till you test it out for yourself. That's my encouragement to anybody. But just consider what I'm saying and see what you, in your own individuality, makes of it. And that's all I'm saying, Rita, basically.
Okay. So I'm just looking at the clock. So we have about 3 or 4 minutes left. Andrew or John, do you have any last words that you would like to share with the listeners before we need to go?
Yes, certainly. I'd like to say that all of this, to me, however you take it as a metaphor or as literal or whatever, is pointing to the immense and limitless capacity of all human beings in their potential. And I think if you look at the man on the who's depicted on the Turin Shroud and all that he achieved, then you can see that he's completely the obverse, the opposite of what these graves represent in terms of a physical way of existing, a physical way of surviving, which is no way of surviving because physicality itself will end. He showed that there's something beyond that, beyond where things break down, where, as he said, where thieves come and steal, which is, after all, as Nigel's point that he's made in his book, that this is what things like the graves are. They're something that wants to take away, not wants to in the sense of motivation in thinking, because they don't have such a thing, but their program will implicitly tend to take away that capacity if people allow it. If we become, like Nigel was saying, like SIM card man and want to lose our humanity in technology and become an amalgam of the physical. And I think John may have something to say here.
Yes, I mean, really just to sort of summarize in a way, you know, I'm fascinated by the continuing sort of thesis that Nigel's putting forward and, you know, and our discussions and being able to discover more about this. I think one of the most important points here, though, is that, you know, we tend to think in our society of you know, more force is better, you know, overwhelming force. And therefore, one has this tendency to look at these sort of aliens, etc., and go, okay, well, if they're doing that to us, why don't we go and smash them or fire rockets at them or whatever? The problem is that type of stance further restricts our own minds to make us more susceptible to these things. And I think really that a take-home message from Nigel's book so far really is that, you know, the linking it up with the Shroud of Turin, really the only way, there's only one thing we can possibly do to actually get away from them, if you like, and that's to actually follow these tenets that Jesus was putting forward to expand our mind, basically to understand more by reducing removing our prejudices so that we have a wider view of everything. That wider view will all add up. And then we actually take our consciousness to the place it should be, which is outside of the realm that these aliens can actually address in force. And I think, you know, that's sort of, I think, one of the most important messages of this.
Just let me thank you, first of all, for your charming and courteous indulgence in letting us go on like this. I haven't meant to do this in any kind of way, but it's been wonderful. You've been a wonderful hostess, and thank you very much for allowing us to get the whole circle in, if you like, you know.
Well, I mean, this is just such a complicated topic with so many pieces to it that it was fascinating to me. And so that's why I just kind of let you have free reign to take it where you guys felt it needed to go, because too much, too many pieces. So I think you did a great job. And thank you all for coming on the show, especially with it being Christmas Eve. And, you know, I don't know where some of you are calling from. Nigel, aren't you like in the UK?
Christmas. And it's a wonderful, at least it's a wonderful symbol of that. And I will talk about this in Hanukkah and in whatever the Buddhists call their great festivals, is Vesak or whatever. It's all there for us to do in terms of discovery, Rita. And I thank you for your charming, charming invitation.
Yes, thank you very, very much for having us. It's been a great honor to be on the show. Thank you.
Thank you, Rita. Well, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to all of you, and have a blessed new year.
Thank you.
And so next week, we're doing our annual astrological preview for the year 2011. And to share that with us, we're going to be speaking with Deborah Clement, a very nice woman, hardcore astrologer, who will be looking at what's going to be coming up for the year 2011, politically, economically, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's bound to be a great show. And so until next week, I'm Dr. Rita Louie. Everyone, have a really great Christmas, and I will talk to you on the other side. Be blessed.
Join host Dr. Rita Louise each week at this time for Just Energy Radio. Point your browser to www.justenergyradio.com for more show information and to contact Dr. Rita. Until next time, remember, it's all just energy.